series inductance, and it doesn't proceed any further. And it stops. That's exactly what you want it to happen. You don't want the RF to come back on the outside of the cable and make the shack hot, if you know what I mean, and have the rest of the cable be the radiator. So you're just trying to wind some number of turns of reactants that gives you the RF choking action. And so you need the most amount of diameter, the most number of turns, as you go down low in frequency because of the way an inductor behaves. You get less inductor reactants at a lower frequency. So that's all you're doing. There's no magic number there. And so if somebody told you 10 inches and you thought it was supposed to be 9.9 inches, you're worrying unnecessarily, as you could tell. Let me drop. So I'm reasonably sure that you're going to find the antenna is quite nowhere near as nice as it used to be when the counterpoise was connected, and you're going to want to reconnect that so-called counterpoise. And as a science experiment, you could make a couple of measurements before you connect and after you connect, and come back and let us know, because you got a couple of real good science experiments going there, Bernie. But if you can borrow from one of your buddies in Queens a antenna analyzer and measure the real impedance on 10 and 12 meters, and then that'll tell you right away what to do. And if you also know the schematic diagram of your particular antenna tuner, and you can therefore find out what portions of the chart, of the Smith chart, it can cover, you'll eventually bring this all together. I know you're going to be radiating on 10 or 12 meters. Only thing left to discover is how many other changes you got to make to make that all happen. Now back to you, Bernie, for any other final. K2 Mike Uniform, please come back and tell us how this project is going. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, great. Really always learning a lot here. So, okay on all of that. And I figured, yeah, that's what I was looking for. I figured the antenna, basically you're saying the antenna gets a bit lame there. It has nothing to push off of between the ballon and not having the counterpoise. So it's got to affect the not only the impedance in SWR, but it must be affecting the whole radiation pattern. I was just curious because I know, you know, I'm learning a lot about this stuff. And anyway, my very final, this is going to be a very quick yes or no because I don't want to take any more time, but very quick yes or no. I'm just guessing that the trouble matching the impedance that I'm having is because basically talking about a 75-foot dipole for 10 meters and 12 meters, and that it's not a coincidence that I'm having trouble tuning on those bands and not on all the other bands. That because the antenna is too many multiples of the wavelength. Is that a more or less accurate?
That's a good guess, Bernie, but it's not that bad. A real half-wave conventional dipole on 10 meters is in the vicinity of 16 feet long. Half-wave on 10 meters, roughly 16 feet. Yours is a 75-foot, which means you're multiple wavelengths long. Being multiple wavelengths long is not bad. However, as the dipole goes from half wavelength long, and eventually as you change the frequency or change the length so that you go to three-quarter wave, one wave, one and a half wave, and so on, there are specific frequencies and wavelengths. There are specific wavelengths where it's very hard to feed the antenna. If you're feeding the antenna in the conventional manner in the center, and if it's a dipole in free space, let me drop. Half wave long gives you something in the vicinity of 70 ohms of impedance. A full wave, 1,000 ohms impedance. 2,000 ohms impedance when you feed the center of a one wavelength dipole. Let me think now. That is 20, that's a 40 to 1 standing wave ratio, just because of the resistive component. Nobody's antenna tuner can handle that. So at that magic number, one wavelength long, it's going to be tough. You keep going up in frequency or up in length of the antenna, so now it's one and a half wavelength long. You come back into something that's much more reasonable impedance. The impedance goes through cycles of length or wavelength versus impedance that you see. And so if you go to the right chapter of the antenna, and the ARL antenna book, it'll give you some of this information. There is a chart in there that shows you what the impedance looks like as you continuously sweep it up in frequency. And you go through some easy and hard impedance matching locations cyclically. So if the antenna was 14 wavelengths long and it was 14 and a quarter, it might be a very nice impedance. where 14.0 would be a terrible impedance and hard to feed. So the fact that it's got extra length is not necessarily bad. The antenna pattern becomes a little bit more complicated. You get some extra lobes in there, but in many cases, that's good. So again, there's a lot more to it than first meets the eye. So as I said, keep coming back to us, Bernie, and let us know how this project is running. You got a lot of fun one there. K2RIW, let's see now. Let's go over to Paul. WS2N, hope we haven't put you to sleep, Paul. And what is NASA doing these days? They're getting real ready to launch Curiosity, I think. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick Edstead, can you add me on for a comment?
Okay, and I'm here. I heard Glenn.
Yeah, let's let Glenn, go ahead with your comment.
I just wanted to suggest, Dick, that I've done a lot of experiments with the vertical vertical half-wave dipole on the HF bands between 10 and at least 80 megahertz. 160 is a little bit of a different subject altogether. But harmonically tuning, if you had to have one element that you wanted to tune just about all the bands on, I would concentrate on 20 meters, because a half wave at 33.2 feet approximately will harmonically tune to just about everything from 10 to 80 with a good antenna tuner. So a little bit longer than that, it'll favor the lower bands. A little bit shorter than that, it'll favor the higher bands. But harmonically, if you tune something to around 20 meters, you should be able to cover most of everything from 10 to 80 with an antenna tuner. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
It sounds like a good beginning, but I've got a problem though, Glenn. On 20 meters, a half-wave dipole will be a full-wave dipole on 10 meters. And a full-wave fed in the center is something close to 2,000 ohms. That's a 40-to-1 standing wave ratio. I think almost no antenna tuner on a 20-meter dipole is going to allow you to feed it on 10 meters. Over to you, Glenn.
Oddly enough, it does. Okay. That's all I can say, Jack. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I'll take your word for it. And maybe the problem here is that we're not exactly the harmonic. In other words, a guy who tunes it up to 20 meters is not tuning it up to 14.00, in which he goes to 10 meters at 28.00, where they're exactly 2 to 1. He probably favors his particular portion of the DX band, 14.250, and now when he goes up to 10 meters, it's not exactly the second harmonic. I think that's part of what's going on. Pure guess on my part. We'll eventually find out. Paul?
Oh, Dick, just one more quick thing on that.
Go ahead, Glenn.
For anybody who's ever tried to build a fan dipole, the low bands between 10 and 80 meters where you're using multiple elements, the quickest way to get there is starting with 20 meters first and then adding the other elements and tuning the other bands. Almost any other way, you'll have you going in circles. But you're right. It actually is being just a little bit off. I think normally you're starting somewhere around like 14.250. And that usually centers everything. 160 is another game altogether, though. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, once you go down to 160 meters, where some guys call it the top band in wavelength, the bottom band in frequency of the popular handbands, all kinds of magic takes place. Different kinds of physics is required down there. The electrons behave differently at 160 meters. I'm exaggerating a little bit. Paul, WS2N, how's Curiosity going? Are we getting close to that launch? I think it's called, yeah, Spirit Navigation. It's called Curiosity. I think we're getting fairly close to that launch. And are you gonna be watching it on satellite television that day? I know the answer is yes, or yes, you're probably going to set your video recorder to record it. You got it, Paul. K2RIW.
Yeah, the recorders will be running as on. Not on part A. They pushed it to Saturday. They want to change out a battery on board. So they delayed it one day. And it would be 10:02 in the morning, 10:02 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. So we've got to see this thing, because we won't hear much of it from now until August of next year when it lands. So this is the... I don't know how many times we talked about Curiosity, but this
finally going to go. It was the day of the Thanksgiving, and now it's going to be Saturday morning. So that should be pretty good. It's going to be mounted on top of an Atlas. Atlas 5, 541 rocket, which is the biggest rocket we use nowadays. The design of the Delta 4 was more or less dropped, and we dropped it years ago. They're not really going to use the Delta 4. That was, I think, a little bit more powerful. But this thing is the top of the heap now. Atlas 5, they call it 541. You always hear those numbers at the end, like three numbers. I thought I'd cover that a little bit this week, what those mean, you know, when they say an Atlas 541 rocket, you know, an Atlas 5. Well, the 5, when they say 541, is the designation for the diameter of the fairing, you know, the top part of that rocket, what's sitting inside the payload. And in this case, if you look at that rocket, you know, it's a nice sleek rocket going up, and near the top it gets real wide. Well, that's 5 meters. It's actually 5.4 meters in diameter on the fairing. So that's where they get the 5 from. So you got 541, drop it, WS-200. And then when they put the middle number, when that comes out as a 4, that means how many solid booster rockets are attached to it. So with a 5.4 meter diameter rocket, you'll have anywhere between, you know, 1 and 5 solid booster rockets attached to it. If you're running a 4 meter, let's say the designation was 441, you couldn't have that. You can't have 4 solids attached to a 4 meter rocket. So, you know, that would be 1 to 3. So in this case now you have a 5, a 4, and a 1. The 1 stands for how many rockets are on board the next stage. In this case, it's the Centaur rocket. So far, they've always been 1. No, you know, the capability is there for 2. Let me drop it. We have the Atlas 5. That's the, you know, there's been Atlas 4s and Atlas 3s and all of that. So it's the Atlas 5, 541. So the 5 is the diameter of the fairing, which they need for this thing. It's a pretty wide cruise stage that's being used for the Curiosity rocket rover. And then you've got the 4 for the 4 solids, and then you've got the 1 for the rocket for the second stage. They have used the Atlas 551. That was used. That was on the New Horizons spacecraft. That's the one that's en route to Pluto now. So they have used the fifth solid. You know, that's the highest you can go on these rockets. 551. They have used that. But this is the 541. It's enough to get it to Mars. That's the name of the game. We drop it. Okay, so I just wanted to cover that. We never really cover much on the launch rockets itself. There's going to be a lot more to these rockets. When eventually we get to back to manned space flight, and you have the newer space launch system that's being developed. So we'll be talking more about heavy-duty launch vehicles in the future. The other thing I want to mention is the funding for the James Webb Space Telescope, another popular topic for the SpaceNet. Part of this whole thing is this thing here is the replacement of the Hubble. Hubble's hopefully we'll get another 5, 6, 7 years out of Hubble, but this thing will replace it. And I just wanted to let you know that the funding, as of a few days ago, has been restored by Congress, according to what I read on Scientific American. The $8.8 billion project is now back. The funding wasn't there. They allocated another, I don't know, billion dollars or so for this thing. So it's good to go. I think it was actually a half a billion dollars I needed for the year to drop it. It was. I mean, it looked like it was could be dead in the water about 6 months or 8 months ago. But now the money has been allocated for it. It was passed in the House. And then a few hours later after that, it was passed in the Senate. So the House gave it 298 votes, right down to 100 against the was 121, and the Senate was 74 and 30 against. So that was good to read about. And it's an expensive project, but it's, you know, it's over what 10-year period. You compare that to the Large Hadron Collider, and that's another probably about a $10 billion project. But that thing's over, you know, 10, 15 years too, maybe 20 years. You know, it's not the most expensive thing. It sounds like it, but the ISS is really probably number one at $100 billion. But that's shared among 16 different countries in maybe 20, 25 years. So when you start dividing the years up and the amount of countries that are involved, it makes a difference. Back to you for any questions, Dick. WS2N.
Once again, that new infusion of money, that was for James Webb. I think I heard you say the word Hubble. Maybe you were comparing it to Hubble. But that's funding for James Webb Telescope, which I think is in the early stages of its construction. Is that true, Paul?
That's what it was for. Yeah, I was comparing it to that's the replacement of really Hubble. 8.8 billion is the predicted price of this thing. I mean, it's big. So I mean, you're looking at the size of a jetliner. Put out 1 million miles out. So and a huge mirror. All the mirrors are really done, completed, polished. So it's well on the way. In fact, there's a website you can go to and watch them building James Webb. They have a couple of webcams. It's well on the way, Dick. So. I just can't wait until this thing's in there in orbit. You know, it's got. I mean, you think Curiosity is complex on how that thing's going to open up? You know. The mirror and this gigantic sunshade as big as a tennis court, you know, that's really a complex thing, and that's all going to be done where you can't really service it. That I want to see. I mean, Curiosity is complex, very complex, but this when you see this James Webb thing on its animation, on how it opens up, you really can't believe it. Back to you, Dick. WS.
Hey, you estimated that the Large Hadron Collider was $8 billion. As of 2010, it was 7.5 billion euros, approximately $9 billion, if I understand correctly. Yeah. Was the price as of 2010. And I'll be telling you a couple more words about what it has discovered in the last week or so. Alrighty, so Saturday, the day after Thanksgiving, the Atlas 541 launches Curiosity, and I think you said 10 o'clock in the morning, and so that's a very convenient time. On a weekday, you'll have time to watch it live as well as recording it on that particular launch. Got a guess as to why they delayed it a day? Is that so people can watch the launch, or does that give them a better alignment of Earth and Mars? What do you think, Paul? Go ahead.
There's some kind of a battery change out. They want to change out something on it. I don't know if it's on Curiosity or where it is. I just read it's some kind of a battery. Some kind of an indicator. They want to change something out. But whatever it is, it's only going to take them that day. Less than that. It was supposed to go Friday morning, but they've switched it now 24 hours. Now, you know, each time they have a window, they do have an hour and 45 minutes to launch it. So it starts at 10:02. So if there's any delays, it might go, you know, it might go an hour later. You don't know. So they got to get it off within about 1 hour and 45 minutes. Yeah, okay, yeah, I know. I did the euro conversion. I saw 7.5 billion on the euros. I don't know. I just figured $10 billion. Give a billion to here, a little, another billion there. Dick, so I guess it around 10 billion. Give you an idea. Shoreham nuclear power plant, which was really paid locally. Oh, yeah, there's federal money involved. But it was a $6 billion bill for 20 years, and I think they only fired it up for about, they had 5% power out of it, and then shut it down, and that was the end of that. So here's this thing, which is going to probably tell you, let me drop it. About, you know, that Hubble was not able to tell us. We're going to get a lot of answers out of this James Webb telescope. The Large Hadron Collider, same thing. They haven't found the Higgs boson particle that they're looking for, which would tell, once they say that, you know, if they could say that they've found this and discovered what they really believe is out there, the Higgs boson particle, then they could say, well, matter came from basically nothing, and this is what they need to prove for their model. They can't prove it yet. They're going to come back. Right now it's shut down. It's going to be shut down for the winter, but after that, they're going to fire it up with a little bit more sensitivity, and they might be able to do it really probably the beginning of next year. If not, then I think there's a one-year shutdown at the end of next year, and then they'll try it again. Let me drop it. Always worry about timing this thing out. And then after that, there was now a new funding in the works for 2020. They're going to really rebuild this whole thing again, really change everything. To make a long story short, it'll be 10 times more sensitive, say another 10 years from now than what it is now. I don't know if you've read that, Dick, but that's already been there. They more or less have the go-ahead on that. So, if they don't find it now, maybe a decade from now, Dick. At that time, they plan on going beyond what they're looking for. This thing might be able to help them investigate dark energy, and even look into the possibility of alternate universes. It's really advanced science 10 years out with this big atom smash. Back to you, Dick. WS2M.
I think you're saying 10 years from now there's going to be a refurbishment that's planned for the Large Hadron Collider that's going to make it 10 times more potent. I forget how many Tesla, the magnets, the superconducting magnets are running right now. And so does that mean they're going to be beefing up those magnets, Paul, to make the machine 10 times more potent? I think it runs, I've forgotten now how many tera electron volts. Run that by a few more times there, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I'm saying 10 times more potent. They're using the word luminosity, Dick. I know you've read a lot about this thing. Maybe that means something to you, but 10 times more luminosity. I'm calling it power. I don't know the speed is almost there. It's almost the speed of light. So I don't know how much closer they could get with that. So maybe luminosity is maybe the ability to read this, you know, in the Atlas or the Phoenix or whatever the detectors that they use. The big one, I think, is called the Atlas. But maybe that's what they need. Back to you.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense. Those superconducting magnets already are close to the state of the art. You'd have to make those magnets about 10 times more sturdy in Tesla magnetic field in order to accelerate that beam are closer to the speed of light. And doing that would be very difficult. Now, luminosity, that's the number of particles in the beam. I mean, you and I could have a beam going around there with one particle, or a million particles. Each little bundle, there's a whole bunch of bundles in that circle, all being accelerated simultaneously. And each bundle has got some number of million or billion of particles in that particular bundle. And there's something like a...
They were talking about.
What was that again?
You have it. That's what they were talking about, the amount of particles in this in that regard with luminosity.
Now, as you build more and more luminosity, that means you're putting more and more particles per bundle or more and more bundles, one or the other. But let's assume that you're trying to put more particles per bundle, let's call it bundle, pulse, whatever you like, and you got something like 1,200 or 1,600 of these bundles around the ring at any one time, and as you try to put more and more particles together, if, for instance, they're protons or electrons, they're heavily charged, they're repelling each other like all hell, they really don't want to be in bundles. They want to push themselves apart. And so the way you do all of that focusing with the magnets pushes them back together. And it takes better and better, finer and finer tuning characteristics in order to make a bundle with more particles that stays together. That's part of the tuning procedure. It's got a great big learning curve to it. You want to say something on that one, Paul?
No, that was somebody else keying up.
Now, putting more bundles, more particles in the bundle, you think that you're smashing these particles together. You got one beam going around the track, the 27-kilometer track clockwise. You got another beam going around counterclockwise. And at certain critical places where you've got a detector, you allow the beams to smash into each other. Other than that, they're running side by side, and you're keeping them apart. So you allow them to smash into each other. And you think you're going to take a particle from the clockwise beam and a particle from the counterclockwise beam and let them hit each other. They don't do that. There's tremendous amounts of space in between those particles. You may have a million particles in each bundle, and you allow them to smash into each other, and you think you're going to get a million collisions. Or maybe you're going to get 100 collisions, because most of them are going to miss. And so luminosity is a function of how many are in the bundle and how tightly packed are they. As you can pack them tighter and tighter together as far as diameter of the bundle, then you have a higher and higher probability of the two beams really individual particles hitting each other. And so as you get higher luminosity, you get more impacts, you get more data. Therefore, you're doing more simultaneous experiments. And with your computer processing, let me drop. With the computer processing of the results of those collisions, you stand a higher and higher probability of looking for that particular fancy little squiggle that you're looking for that represents your particular particle. It's got just the right mass, just the right velocity, just the right radius of curvature, showing you it's got the right charge to mass ratio, and then you say, aha, I found my particle. Well, you're going to find a lot more of them if you've got higher and higher luminosity. So the 10-to-1 improvement in luminosity is where you're going to get a 10-to-1 improvement in the number of collisions, the number of experiments that you run simultaneously. So that's what's going to be carefully tuned down range as they go through those learning curves. Too bad they haven't found it yet. But now, what CERN has been doing, as when they dump the beam, and the beam has got lots of megajoules of power, and when you dump that beam, you if something goes wrong with the machine, you sense a failure is about to begin. You don't want the beam damaging your magnets, damaging your vacuum tube and whatever. You don't want that beam hitting anything other than a control target. So if for whatever reason you want to dump the beam, you aim it into a great big carbon block, and that's going to take these megajoules and turn it into heat and absorb your beam. However, when you do that, you're aiming the beam into a great big carbon block, which is your dummy load, so to speak, it generates neutrons, neutrinos. Neutrinos are the ones that go right through that carbon block, go right through the dirt. They go 732 kilometers away, and they arrive in Italy at something that's called the Gran Sasso National Laboratory. And the Gran Sasso National Laboratory is 1,400 meters below ground. That's 0.87 miles below ground. And the reason they did that is because they got this great big neutrino detector called OPERA. O-P-E-R-A stands for Oscillating Project with Emulsion tracking apparatus. Anyhow, so they got this neutrino detector that's 1,400 meters below ground. And I'm guessing the main reason they did that is to make sure it doesn't get false alarmed with cosmic rays. As you put a detector further and further underground, less and less of the cosmic rays from space get there and give you a false alarm. And therefore, you stand a higher probability of seeing nothing but the neutrinos in that detector. And there's a particular signature those neutrinos have, and you recognize that. You don't want a whole lot of noisy other signals in there. So this beam from CERN goes through 731 kilometers of dirt between Switzerland and Italy, arrives 1,400 meters below ground, and a small, small number of those neutrinos get picked up by this detector, and you carefully time those. The original experiment, they were transmitting pulses that were 10 microseconds long of neutrinos, and carefully counting the nanoseconds it takes for them to get there. Well, there's a lot of things wrong with 10 microsecond long pulses when you're trying to make a 10 nanosecond measurement. I guess that's a 2,000 to 1 ratio, and you could really make an error there. They repeated the experiment in the last week or two, where they started transmitting 1 nanosecond pulses, I think, instead of 10 microsecond pulses. And they repeated the experiment, and they got the exact same answer. The neutrinos alive 60 nanoseconds too soon, faster than the speed of light. And so the experiment is repeating. And a hell of a lot of the supposed errors have all been crossed off. And there's a medium good chance that we're starting to see evidence that something can move faster than the speed of light. Not a whole lot faster, but the fact that it's faster at all has got people really, really bugged, if you know what I mean. I mean, just...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
When it comes to the Big Bang of this universe, you know that the Big Bang started off with a very large explosion. All the mass of what we observe in the observable universe got spread out like a bomb going off, and those particles all have some kind of a central point where they started. There's a whole lot of gravity involved, and everyone believes that the gravity is going to eventually suck those particles back together, and the Big Bang is going to become a big crunch. So 10 or 15 or 20 or so years ago, they started making measurements to find out, okay, how fast is this thing slowing down? When is the big crunch going to occur? And as they made more and more careful measurements, two separate experiments at least, discovered that the outer material is not slowing down, it's speeding up. And so that became what's called dark energy. Nobody knows what dark energy is, but the stuff at the perimeter of that Big Bang is not slowing down, it's speeding up. At first, nobody could believe that. Well, now that experiment has been repeated and tested enough times, it is apparently fact, very strong evidence on it, that it's really there. And now you've got to explain what's doing it. Well, the same thing with these neutrinos. We're getting more and more evidence that they move faster than the speed of light. And that can be kind of handy at times. The percentage of increase is 20 parts per million, but still, it is faster than light. And can you make them go faster yet? We'll soon find out. Fun experiment. If you Google the words faster than light neutrinos, you'll get a whole lot of hits. When you start reading those articles, you'll find out what's going on. And it's kind of fun stuff. Now, one of the questions I got for John, KC2WGB, now that we've got those beautiful pictures of your laboratory, let me drop that are on QRZ.com. You look up QRZ.com and go to KC2WGB. You see John's laboratory with a zillion pieces of test equipment. Out of curiosity, John, if you made the mistake of turning on every one of those pieces of test equipment simultaneously, I wonder if you have enough current capability in your house to do that. You would really be spinning the Con Edison dial at a rapid rate, chewing up electricity like crazy. Have you estimated the rough number of kilowatts you'd consume if you turned on every one of your instruments at once? KC2WGB, K2RAW in the tech band.
Well, Dick, I have a separate service for the lab. It's a 115-amp service, and the bench alone has 80 receptacles. So it has 24 circuit breakers. The total current, I never measured. I really didn't even worry about it because I knew I had enough supply. That'll give you an idea. And don't forget, you're only really looking at half the lab in this picture.
Make a rough guess, John. On the worst case day in the last 5 or 10 years, what's the maximum number of instruments you turned on all at once?
I happen to have that note, 31.
Wow. Is there one great big master switch right by that white door? When you flip the switch, you can turn off everything at once?
Well, more importantly, there's a fire extinguisher hanging there. No, they're individual breakers on the bench. And then at the exit door, there's a main breaker, 125 main breaker, to shut everything down. I could kill the whole lab by pulling one lever.
That main breaker, is it literally a lever and a great big knife switch, or is it a circuit breaker that you're opening up? Over to you, John. I didn't know that they made circuit breakers as big as 150 amperes, by the way.
Oh, yeah, I got a couple of 600 amp breakers sitting here, larger frame breakers, but yes, that's just a simple circuit breaker. It's about, I would say, 2.5 inches by 2 inches high, and it's, the panel depth is maybe 3 inches.
If that's truly a circuit breaker that's made to trip when you exceed some given amount of current, like 150 amps, and in theory you could use that as a master switch on or off, I recommend you do not do that. I think we've been down that road already. Let me pass it back to you to let you know whether or not I should waste your time explaining why I think that shouldn't happen. Over to you, John.
KC2WGV. I don't really use that as a kill switch. That's not a good idea to trip a breaker that size under load. But I use my circuit breakers for the lighting as switches. I've been doing it for years. Never had a problem. But you've got to buy quality breakers.
And if you buy quality breakers, maybe you can get away with it. But I think many of the electrical engineers, power savvy people, will recommend not using a circuit breaker as an on-off switch under load. If the load is light enough, no problem. But if the load is kind of heavy, like if you're operating the circuit breaker at 80% of load and you trip it as an on-off master switch, you are arcing those contacts. You only get a certain number of those arcs before the contacts will eventually fail. Maybe if you buy one with a high enough quality factor, maybe the contacts are made for 150 amperes and it's only a 35 ampere a breaker, and maybe they can take it for almost ever. And maybe that's what you've done. But I think the recommendation is another kind of master on-off switch, something that looks like a great big knife switch internally, as opposed to using the circuit breaker, I think is the recommendation.
KC2QIQ?
Yeah, go ahead on that one, Glenn.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Dick. Basically, a circuit breaker is a trip device. It's really not designed as a switch. I know it can be operated as a switch temporarily, but if you look at the amount of open enclosures that are guaranteed on a circuit breaker as opposed to a switch, a switch is typically rated for open enclosures in numbers like, you know, 100,000 open enclosures in its lifetime before a switch will actually wear out. But even switches themselves do wear out. But circuit breakers are rated basically not to make open enclosure. They're really supposed to design at a current trip. So if they're constantly being used on and off, you are wearing them out prematurely. And, of course, if you keep on opening and closing it under load, the rating of the circuit breaker is going to degrade over, you know, for the amount of open enclosures that you do. And usually if there's a data sheet on the breaker, we'll tell you pretty much how many times. Just one other quick comment, Dick, is that I bet you do have one of these high current circuit breakers actually in your house. If you look in your main breaker and go all the way on the top of your fuse box, most houses usually have like something in the order of about 100 to a 200 amp main breaker disconnect up on the top of your box. So you might even have one right in your own house, Dick. Keith rides up your KC2QIQ.
I'm going to give you a funny story along those lines in a minute. But before I do, a good real on-off switch that looks internally like a knife switch, quite possibly it can take 100,000 or maybe 500,000 closures under load. What's your guess, Glenn, a real circuit breaker, I'm running at 80% of load capability. I'm If I had to make a guess, I would say 1,000 closures is probably pushing your luck. What do you feel, Glenn? Go ahead.
I would say that if you took a brand new one out of the box and under load, let's say if it's a 15 amp breaker and you were like somewhere, you know, in excess of 10 amps somewhere, and you got 1,000 closures out of that at 10 amps, boy, you got a good breaker. KTRI WKC2QIQ.
WSON 6.
Paul recognized, and another thing that's going on here is that if it's rated for 15 amperes, and you think you've got a load of 10 amperes, and if some of that load happens to be a refrigerator, a toaster, a microwave oven, things like that, each of these things have a starting current that's a hell of a lot higher. A light bulb draws about 15 times the steady state current, an incandescent light bulb, when you first turn it on. You can prove that real fast by putting your ohm meter across an incandescent light bulb. When it's cold, it has somewhere between 1/10 and 1/15 of the normal resistance. A motor on a refrigerator, the compressor motor, locked rotor, is going to draw 10 times normal amount of current. So when you're first closing that circuit breaker and you think you've got a 10 ampere load, there's a slim possibility that for the first few microseconds it's a 50 ampere load, and as those contacts come together and they're bouncing, they're arcing and sparking with 50 amperes on contacts that are rated for 15 amperes. So as you can see, under load in the real world, the total number of closures, Glenn feels that even 1,000 closures could be pushing it. I think he's right. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, how about using these big disconnect switches? You know, I used to use them all the time. They were attached to all these rooftop air conditioning units. You know, you, before you work on them, you would just pull this one big lever. They were nice. I don't know what they cost. I never bought one, but, you know, every system I ever worked on, first thing you do is shut that off. And then, you know, what you're supposed to do, of course, is if you're going to work on it, you put your own lock on there and you walk away, so it turns it on again if you're somewhere else in the building. But that's all it was. I mean, you know, it has three big switches inside the one thing. As you turn that switch, they would all disconnect, big disconnect switches. And the ones I used were always outdoors. They were all waterproof and all, you know, they were great. You know, you put that on, and you know, in lieu of using circuit breaking thing.
Yeah, that's OSHA code.
This thing that you just described, Paul, I guess it's weatherproof and it's outdoors. If you could see inside, is there the equivalent of a knife switch where you're opening up a V-shaped contact and a blade that goes down the V-shaped contact, and when you open that up, there's an inch or two of spacing, and there's a real mechanical, great big disconnect going on. Is that what's really going on inside that thing that you're describing, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, and it would, you know, you'd have your three, you know, it would be like a 220 box, for instance, and you'd have your three connections going in. When you move that, this linkage would, you know, they would all gang together. So when you threw that lever, all three would either connect or disconnect it.
And when you move that lever, I think you're saying there's a new position it goes to, and you've got a couple of holes there where you can put your lock through, and it's your combination lock, and you're the only guy that knows the combination. You put your lock through there, and now, in theory, nobody can come along and turn it on while you're working on it. Is that the recommended procedure, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's it, definitely. Yeah, what could happen is you could go downstairs and be working on the evaporator section or something like that, and you know you think the whole thing is powered down, and somebody another maintenance guy goes up there and hey, look at this, I got, who turned this off? You know, you don't want that to happen.
I'm guessing the procedure is not only to put a lock, but to put a sign saying I Paul, union number so and so, on this date, turn this off. This is my phone number if you want to talk to me. And while I'm doing work on the system, it's going to be my lock in there. I'm guessing you're supposed to put some kind of a sign on there informing anybody who comes along what's going on. Is that approximately true, Paul?
I never came across that in the commercial or industrial world, but who knows, maybe in a comment dictation that might require that, you know. I mean, I was out at Brookhaven Lab. They didn't require it, but, you know, maybe at NASA or some high tech facility might require that. But, no, as far as the, just your own lock was good enough. We were never told to hang signs. Good idea. More to merrier. You don't want somebody coming along with a big cutter and cut the lock off. That could happen.
And I think it was in the Navy that John has worked on some real high power systems. I'm guessing the recommended procedure, John, is that you know you're going to be shutting the thing down 2 days from now. You issue a memo or emails or whatever to the crew saying that between this hour and that hour, the system is going to be shut down. You inform the crew ahead of time, I'm guessing. You hang a sign on that switch. You hang your lock through those contacts to make sure it can't be restored. And now, in theory, you're a little bit safe. Is that about the way the Navy did it, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW?
Not only the Navy, Dick, it's common practice now. Not only do you have to have lockout where you insert your lock in a clamp device that goes on the handle, prevents it to move, there are multiple holes in that card. You put your lock in there. Now, somebody else is going to work on it after you can put their lock in another hole. It is a criminal offense to remove a lock that you did not place on there. Criminal offense now. And the picture of you and your home phone number and all of that is on the cards now.
Well done. How long ago was that procedure established to your knowledge, John?
It started in earnest about 10 years ago because we worked large power plants on land and on piers. It started about 10 years ago, but now it's accepted. They don't care if it's a 100-volt circuit, and you better have your flash suit with you. That's also a requirement along with your hot stick and detectors, all the Salisbury equipment.
Yeah, give me a couple words on that, flash suit. In other words, if you're opening up a real high voltage circuit or a high current circuit, there's an arcing that could take place that if you're not properly protected, arcs and sparks and ultraviolet will hit your body. Is that what's going on here, John?
Yeah, Dick. It's a very uncomfortable suit. It's mainly Kevlar, and it has Teflon layers. It's a layered fabric, and you wear a hood with a face mask. They make it in several KVA ratings. The gold mask is the highest rate that I ever used, and that will protect you from an explosion. Even if something happens from flash and burn, it will protect you. And this flash suit is like $2,700, and it's only good for one time.
That makes some sense. The incident that I ran into at the company I used to work at, was a 400-cycle, three-phase, 220-volt circuit, real high-voltage power supply. A person was working on the primary winding of that power transformer. There was a circuit breaker on that circuit at something like 30 amperes. And he had been led to believe that the power was turned off, and it wasn't. And in the process of doing his work, his screwdriver fell across two of the phases of a 220 three-phase circuit. And as that screwdriver partially melted, arced, and his face was a hand, you know, an arm's length away from that screwdriver, his face became sunburned, his eyebrows were singed, his hair was singed, and I don't think he suffered eye damage, but I think the skin got at least a first degree and maybe a second degree burn from the arcing that took place. The arc was probably only there for a fraction of a second, and then the screwdriver dropped away, and the 30 ampere circuit breaker on that circuit did not trip. So the event was brief enough. maybe it was a 60 ampere, but I thought it was a 30 ampere circuit breaker, three-phase circuit breaker. It did not trip. I wonder if you ever heard of stories like that one, Glenn. I mean, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Oh, absolutely, Dick. I could tell you horror stories all night. That is called coordination error. Any services that we did had to be coordinated from the Edison service to the outlet. Now, that went through maybe like a 4,000 amp break.
KD2BAH.
Breaking down to three-phase 480 panels with 20 amp circuit breakers. All had to be coordinated because what actually can happen, you can have a 50 amp breaker not trip and have a 2,500 amp down the line trip. And that shouldn't happen. And that's a coordination study that was not done right. Or somebody just didn't do the calculation. But, yep, I've seen those tools like a half-inch ratchet set, supposedly a dead bus bar. The socket and the extension fell off the ratchet handle and fell across the 4,000 amp bus. And the fuses did not blow. The limiters blew out on the Edison side of the transformer, which is really unusual. And that was due to bad coordination. And the thing got hurt. Not bad, but luckily the door was half closed. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, John. A lot to be learned there. Kevin, KD2 Baker Alpha Hotel. I think you have a comment on this. Go right ahead. K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Hey, Dick. How are you? I'm actually an electrician, and I can give you a little bit of insight on that. When a circuit is defaulted to ground or to the neutral, generally the circuit breaker will pop, for the most part, instantaneously. Sometimes it takes a few seconds, sometimes it don't. But now what happens is when one phase shorts out against another phase, like what you were explaining happened with that screwdriver, because the phases are rapidly cycling, turning on and off, on and off, on and off, the phases actually aren't... the circuit breaker to make the circuit breaker trip, because what's happening is as they on and off, the phases are using each other as what's called a floating neutral, which is generally why the breaker doesn't trip. And the reason why most of the time it backfeeds and blows up LiPa's transformer is because LiPa's transformers, give or take, one transformer generally does On single phase residential, one transformer generally does anywhere from 4 to 8 houses, depending on the size of the transformer and its location. By the way, I'm on the road in South Carolina. I'm going to visit my folks. That's why I don't know if I sound good or not. I'm on my phone. But what happens is, because there's already a heavy, heavy load on the transformer from all the surrounding houses, when it spikes back like that, it usually overloads the front end on the transformer, which causes the transformer to drop out. Back to you, Dick. I came in the middle there and heard it and just figured I'd give a little insight.
Very fine, Kevin. Interesting information. To your knowledge, Kevin, is there a way that I could redesign a circuit breaker so that, yes, it trips very nicely when you get a fault from one of the phases to Earth, but is there a way of giving it additional sensing capability so that it can sense the current that flows between phases, because you've got that kind of a short? The fact that it gives less protection on a short, on a fault between phases, strikes me as troublesome. Now, maybe that's going to make the circuit breaker very expensive, or maybe it's going to have a lot of false alarms. But I'd like to believe I could add an additional circuit to the circuit breaker that could latch it into the ineffective mode when there's a lot of current flowing in between the phases. Yes, one phase is becoming a source, another phase is becoming a load, it's becoming back-fed. KD2, BAH, mobile, probably in a tractor-trailer truck. K2RIW in the deck net.
Actually, Dick, I'm in my van. I'm actually trailering my 66 Mustang behind me, bringing it down to my father's down in the Carolinas. And yes, you can. It's actually a breaker already invented. There's two types of breakers. You can use one or the other. There's an arc fault breaker, which is made in a two-pole, 220 style. And there's also a GFCI, ground fault circuit interrupter, breaker, also made in a two-pole, 220 format. Now, what an arc fault breaker does, an arc fault breaker monitors internally. It's not a digital piece of equipment. It's just a breaker. And what it basically does is it senses the balanced load going from hot back into neutral. So, if you have a lamp on or something on that circuit, it's monitoring the current flow. And what an arc fault breaker does, if it senses a large surge of electricity, in other words, let's say you had your vacuum cleaner turned on in the on position, and then you went and plugged it into an outlet, that initial quick jolting surge that's not normally there would create a small arc in the outlet when you first plugged it in, because you would not be able to physically plug it in fast enough to prevent that arc. That would cause the breaker to trip. It's called an arc fault breaker. It's designed to detect any type of arc or any type of overflow in a rapid motion on that circuit.
Okay, so the arc fault breaker is the one that protects us. Is that kind of a breaker twice the normal cost, Kevin? KB2 VAH, K2RIW?
Sorry, I actually got kicked off there, but I got back on there just in time to catch what you said. I'm doing 70 miles an hour down 95, so every once in a while it kicks me off. A typical two-pole 20 amp arc fault breaker, it's a lot more than double the cost. The two-pole 20 amp arc fault breaker, which is a 220 20 amp breaker, is generally, depending on the style of panel you have, anywhere between the $40 and $60 range.
Interesting. Now, I am curious. You're in an automobile going 70 miles an hour, and I think you said you're talking to us through your cell phone. I'm kind of curious. Your cell phone is dialed in where to get into the network to get back to us. How are you doing this, Paul? Kevin? KD2BAH, K2RIW.
Well, Dick, that's simple. I have the Echo Wake Android application downloaded on my Android smartphone, and I'm logged into Echo Wake just as I would my normal computer at home, and I'm basically using the phone as a two-meter radio. I'm linked into the Glen Oaks repeater through the Echo Wake. And that's how I'm making this wonderful trip from 20 miles north of Charleston, South Carolina. Back to you, Dick.
Fascinating. And hopefully there's a way of charging your cell phone while you drive so you don't drain it. Some of the cell phones for a while there, I guess it was Droid or was it Razer, you could plug in an earpiece or you could plug in the charger, but you couldn't do both while you're driving. There wasn't enough connectors on the machine. Alrighty. John, KC2WGB.
KC2QAQ with a question? With a comment.
Rich, before you continue, also don't forget about the funny story you're going to tell us.
Yeah, that I will. Go ahead, Glenn.
Just a couple of comments about, arc fault breakers, ground fault interruption breakers, and just standard breakers. Look at all the different breakers. Most circuit breakers in general are very slow operating devices. It takes many, many milliseconds if you look at the data sheets on these things. So let me let this drop for a second. What I wanted to mention here, Dick, was that if you look at basically a circuit breaker wired on 220 as opposed to, or on let's say in a multi-phase network as opposed to just regular line to neutral, what will happen is if you look at the power, because current is just current, so the power on the breaker from line to neutral is one power range. Now, if that breaker is going across 220, but basically